greatest fear that we have, it seems to me, is our fear that we're alone or of being alone. People fear this idea of that I am really alone. I mean, did you ever stop and think about, like, dying? You know, like, you know you're going to die, right? I mean, we all know this. Everybody, even if you read Deepak's books and you know that it's ageless body and so on, there's still a part of you that says everything in the physical domain is in transition. So even if I can figure out a million years, you know, there's still going to come a time. You know, that's why I often think about the real health food fanatics, you know, the ones who eat tofu and do everything exactly the way they're supposed to do. You know, I wonder what's going to happen to them someday when they're all in a hospital bed and they're all, you know, dying, you know, and they're dying from nothing. You know, it's like, what's wrong with you? Nothing. You're just dying. When you think about this concept of dying, isn't the most fearful thing, didn't you do this when you were a kid? I certainly did. And I think about, okay, let's just say I'm going to be dead 1,000 years. I can handle that. But forever? And that whole concept of forever, and it's like never, and 1 billion years is going to go, and you go, ah, it's just too much. You push that out. But you see, there's a part of you, even though it isn't well-trained, there's a part of you that knows that you're eternal, that can never die. The part of you that's been with you since you were a little child. The part of you that looks out. You know, I was giving a talk up in Boston not too long ago, and my wife was with me, and I finished running, and it was in the morning, and it was about 5:30, 6 o'clock. It was just a real beautiful morning, a nice, cool, crisp morning in March up in Massachusetts, and I was running on a track across the street from the high school, and hotel, my wife was standing in front of the hotel saying, come on, let's go to breakfast. And I had just finished running. And she was waving to me. She said, come on, we've got to go. You've been out there for 2 hours. For crying out loud. Come on. And so there was a fence between her and I. And I was running towards her. And I saw this fence. And the fence was about 3.5, maybe 4 feet high. And when I was in high school, I was a high jumper on the team. So a four-foot jump isn't a really big deal. And I ran up to the fence. And I hurtled over the fence. I just jumped the fence. And she screamed at me. She said, you can't do that. You're 55 years old. When you're 55 years old, you don't jump over fences. You're going to kill yourself. And I said, I forgot. And I did. I forgot. Because the part of me that has been in there looking out has never aged. It hasn't aged at all. It's the part of me that doesn't know anything about age. I mean, I look in the mirror, and I look back, and I see hairs falling out, you know. And I ask that metaphysical question, you know, what held it in yesterday? You know, something did. I don't know what it is. But there's a little boy in there, and there's a teenager in there, and there's a 30-year-old in there, and there's a 40-year-old in there. And I was walking along the beach not too long, and I saw this man. He was well into his 90s. I mean, he was like creaking along in the beach. And this woman walked by with this thong bathing suit on. Gorgeous, you know. And he was walking, and all of a sudden when she went by him, he turned and he went, ah, and he looked. I could hurt his neck to look, but he had to look. And I said, it's a life sentence, you know. I mean, he doesn't know. I mean, the part of him that is looking and observing and noticing hasn't aged at all. It's just the package that has. So the highest self is this fear of being alone, this idea that we're alone, when you know, as it said in the Course in Miracles, you knew who walked beside you at all times. If you knew that there is a force that is with you and walking with you at all times, you would transcend that idea, that fear that you're alone, and you would know it. Carl Jung, who spent a good part of his life studying these ideas, who was a great teacher in my life, studied these ideas, and when he was dying, he was asked, do you believe there's life after death? Because he had studied about this and written about this. And he said, no. He said, I don't believe that. I know it. I absolutely know it. There is no doubt, you see. Because Jung said, there are really four stages, if you will, or what he called archetypes, that we all go through as adults. And many of you listening here today on this program will recognize that the emphasis that I have placed over the years has shifted, and often ask why. And when I'm asked that question in interviews, I always say to the interviewer, it's because I have been through these stages, these archetypes. The lowest stage is what he called the stage of the athlete. And the stage of the athlete is a stage in which it's the time in our lives. This is not a put-down of athletes, by the way, or athletics. It's just an archetype for the time in our lives when our primary emphasis is on our physical appearance, what it looks like, how strong it is, how much it can lift, and so on, how fast it can run. It's the stage of our preoccupation with our physical body, how beautiful it is, how attractive it is. This is a lot of looking in the mirror time and so on in our lives. And I can remember being there in my life and having this as the primary focus of my life. What does my body look like? And I am this body. He said the second stage, the second archetype, is what he called the stage of the warrior. And he said this is the time in your adult life when you take your physical body out into the world and do with it what warriors do. And what warriors do is they conquer, they defeat, they compare. This is the age of the ego. This is the time in your adult life now when you put your attention on what's in it for me, what are my quotas, how much can I get, who am I better than. This is the time of we're number one. You see all of that all over the country, especially during football season with the kids putting, we're number one, we're number. It's the idea of having to compare yourself, of thinking about getting yours before somebody else gets it, that you're in competition with everyone else. There's only so much abundance. There's only so much that I can have in my life, and I have to get it before somebody else gets it. And if I don't, then they're going to get it, and so on. And so I have to defeat other people. It's the age of the ego. It's the time in our lives when we learn separation. I am separate from you. I am separate from everyone out there, and I have to get mine. Then the third stage is what Jung called the stage of the statesman. And this is the time in our adult lives when we shift our emphasis out of what's in it for me and stop asking the question, what are my quotas, and we begin to say, what are yours? And how may I serve becomes your mantra. And here is when you begin to have that paradox, that you begin to understand that all the things that you sought after when you were an athlete and when you were a warrior begin to show up in your life when you're a statesman in even larger numbers, but they show up in a way in which you're no longer attached to them. It's like, it's okay. The abundance shows up and you say, yeah, that's fine, and you let it flow because the nature of this divine organizing intelligence that is over on the left side of the room, this future pull, this potentiality, this part of you, this higher part of you, is one which has no boundaries to it. And it is not attached to holding on to anything. And so as a statesman, you begin to put your attention on serving others. And companies that do this tend to flourish much more than those who are most concerned about the bottom line. It's the time in our lives when we stop thinking about how much can I get from somebody else and instead say, here, would you like some of mine? And then we find out when we do that, that more comes into our lives. And then Jung said that the highest stage, what he called the stage of the spirit, is the time in our adult lives when ultimately we begin to realize that we're none of the previous three. That we are not athletes, we're not warriors, we're not statesmen at all. That in fact we're not even human beings having a spiritual experience. Indeed, that it's the other way around, that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. And the quality of our human experience is one in which we can recognize our own divinity. And we know that this is not our home. We are, as Jesus said in the New Testament, we are in this world, but we're not of this world. And we come to know this. And therefore, we are capable of being in the world, filling out the forms, and doing whatever it is that we do in our lives, and recognizing at all times that we are not of this world. I now am no longer what I notice. I am the noticer. I no longer am what I witness. I am the witness. I'm no longer what I observe. I am the observer. And as you do this, you begin to live from the highest place. You're no longer the athlete, even though you might be athletic. You're no longer the warrior, even though you might be very competitive and you might have a whole lot of goals that you are working on. But that isn't your primary identification. You're not even the statesman who is serving and working to make the world a better place. You are that which is eternal. That which is always there, never ages, never dies, has no boundaries, and is your highest and your most sacred self. And it isn't just a matter of listening to this tape and saying, yeah, okay, I got that. It's a matter of living from that perspective. Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher and scientist, said that all of man's troubles stem from his inability to sit quietly in a room alone. Most of us don't know how to do this. We're not trained in this. We somehow think that the solutions to our life problems are out there, not in here where we drop the key. They're out there. And they're not. They're within. The mind is like a pond where you take a pebble and you drop it into the pond. And on the surface of the pond are all the disturbances. All of the wind and the rain and the storms and all of the things that you see are on the surface. The mind is like that, only at the surface of the mind is called chatter. Endless, endless chatter. Constantly rethinking and going through over and over again. And quieting is not possible for you. And when you understand that as the pebble drops, a little more, you get to these various levels in your mind. And you can train yourself to do this. I can't imagine my life without meditation, without having that peaceful time, 1 or 2 hours every day. And it isn't something that you have to do in a chair, in a lotus position, in a cave, contemplating your navel. You can do it in the middle of a tennis match. You can do it while you're preparing dinner. You can do it anytime, in the middle of a meeting, when you learn how to go within and get very quiet. And see the breath as taking you up and down into this quiet place. And as the pebble drops deeper, you go through these levels. You go through what we call analysis. You're past chatter now, a little deeper into the mind. The pebble is dropping. In analysis, it's called that intellectual violence, where you're picking everything apart. Why does this do this? And why is that? And picking that up. And then it begins to drop a little more into what we call synthesis. And you're no longer picking apart the world in your mind just by sitting quietly. That's all. And you get to a place where you now see how the whole thing is held together. You see the connection in that invisible place. And ultimately, the pebble drops even further to where you begin to quiet the mind. No synthesis, no analysis, no chatter. Quiet. And the pebble comes ultimately to rest in this thing that we call the unified field. And in the unified field, as St. Mark said, to he that knoweth, all things are possible. People who take the time to go within and make that a part of their regular daily routine don't seem to be troubled. They seem to age less. They seem to have less stress. They seem to be more calm in their life. And I can't tell you how many business people I meet who have their own little ritual that they don't even like to talk about because they might be perceived as being too weird. But a very good friend of mine who's a very, very prominent attorney in South Florida, I asked him one time, I said, do you meditate, David? And he said, no, he said, I never really had time for meditation and all that. He said, but I do take about 15 or 20 minutes a couple times a day, and I go into my mind and I solve most of the cases that I'm working on in that way, in that real quiet space. He said, but I've never had any training in it or anything. And I'm not really talking here about training or any formal way of doing it. Just taking the time to quietly go within and access that highest part of yourself is something that spiritual beings know is absolutely
absolutely, without qualification, necessary to be able to manifest real magic, whereas this non-spiritual being just sees that as something they don't have time for. They've got things to get done. I can't imagine my life without meditation. A few years ago, I couldn't imagine my life with it. I don't know how else to reach the higher self, how else to reach the unified field. See, at the level of where your mind is working, say right now, if you're driving along or listening to this tape in some way, the level that your mind is working is at the analytical level. You analyze it. I call it the chatter level. And you discover how slimy your mind really is at this level. It's what I think of as intellectual violence, this analysis. You picking that apart and picking this apart and drawing that and having these conversations with yourself. And it's like you're tearing everything apart in your mind. And it's almost intellectually a violent thing to do, to tear apart and to pick apart. And that's the way your mind works at this, say, the surface level. And we're doing this all the time, analyzing this and figuring out that and so on. But there's another way of processing your world, and that's through what's the opposite of analysis, which is synthesis. Analysis is to tear apart, pick apart. Synthesis is to bring together and put everything together. Now, as you go a level down from the surface of your mind, you go past analysis, and you get to the synthesis level where you can start to bring everything that happened to you in your life together. And then you get to a point where you stop the analyzing, and your goal is now to just have silence. But then you want to get past just the silence, and you want to get to a place where you can empty your mind, just empty it. But the only thing you have to do this with is your mind, so that that becomes a gigantic paradox. So now what you're looking for is really a quiet mind. And when you keep going down in this level, it's almost like thinking of the mind as like the ocean. And at the top of the ocean is the surface. And at the surface, there's all of these disruptions down to about 2 feet. If there's a windstorm, if there's something that comes along, you'll see that there's disturbances at the top. And the very surface is filled with all of these disturbances. And there's ducks that land on it. And there's all kinds of waves and the wind and the tides and all of this affected. Then you go down a little bit further, and there's much more stillness. And you keep going down further, and you keep going down deeper and deeper and deeper into it until you reach this place that I have been calling the unified field, which isn't, I didn't originate that by any means. And in this unified field, all things are possible. All of us are connected, and there's like a physiological changes that take place. So your objective in meditating is really to get to this transcendent stage where you can get past chatter, and you can get past analysis, and you can get past synthesis, and you can get past thoughts, and you can get to empty it, and then you can get it to be very, very quiet and very still. You'll find yourself meditating more all the time, not having to go into some deep meditative kind of experience where you have to be alone, and you have to have no noise, and you have to have all distractions removed, and you have to have music playing or anything like that. You'll find yourself in 3 or 4 seconds being able to go into, wherever you are, being able to go into a peaceful meditative state and have God right there with you. You'll find yourself able to do that once you believe that God is there for you. Once you know that your guide and multisensoriness that is beyond just your 5 senses, that there's a world beyond that. Once you believe that and know that, you'll be able to go there. And you will consult it often. And I would recommend that you do. Do it in the middle of a meeting. Excuse yourself and just go to the bathroom. And just go find a place that you can sit down for a few minutes. And watch your breathing and close your eyes. Regroup yourself and get yourself very, very peaceful. Sometimes people will call me on the telephone right in the middle of when I'm doing this at my office. I'll just stop in the middle of whatever it is that I'm doing and they'll call and say, "Wow, what were you doing? Were you sleeping?" I'll say, "No, I wasn't sleeping. I was just meditating." And I'll be very, very, there's no stress in your voice at all. You know, you can go there at any time. There are many beautiful things that you can read. The libraries are filled with the wonderful books, and more of them are coming out all the time. And you'll find yourself doing that more and more. You'll find yourself excited about going to some of the material that you'll find for yourself in your life. I mean, reading the Bhagavad Gita was like that for me. Writing You'll See It When You Believe It was like that for me. And even now, I still go back and read it all the time. And many, many other fine things, of course, written by many great scholars. Tapes are another phenomenal thing that that you can listen to at any time. Very often when I run, I put a tape in and I just let Earl's voice, my dear friend Earl, who passed on not too long ago, who I'm with very often in my meditations and can see him right there and even guides me and talks to me. It's magnificent because you know that you can't kill thought, you can only kill form. And Earl Nightingale is there with me very often. It's like learning to be quietly in a room alone, learning to allow yourself the serenity of doing that. You can also, with the people that you love, just have quiet time together. Instead of having a television on, you can just hold each other for, even if it's only for 5 minutes time, just put your arms around the person that you love and just hold them and tell them that you love them and that you're glad that they're in your life. That's a powerful little thing to do. With your children, you can just hold their hand for a few minutes and squeeze them real hard and tell them how great they are, or go for a little walk with them, or go look at a flower with them. On the job, you can develop a real sense of serenity by doing something really unexpected in the direction of being gentle and kind. You know, if you're a macho guy who's never done it before, bring in some flowers for someone that you really care about, or send them a little note, or leave them a donut in the morning and just say, just to let you know I appreciate you. Those are the kinds of little tiny things. They may not sound like much, but all of those kinds of actions which are in the direction of giving rather than receiving are indications of your spiritual advancement and you're coming in contact with that beautiful, endless universe within you, the universe of love and harmony.
Anybody in here that's never had a dream? So you all dream. What do you do when you dream? Where do you go? People ask me over and over again, well, where do you think you go when you die? I say, where do you go when you go to sleep? Where do you go? Why do you have to have a place? Because you can only think linear. You can only think form. And that's what a place is, isn't it? Try to imagine yourself as a multidimensional human being. Multidimensional. And that one of the dimensions you experience is form. And that there are many other dimensions to you as well. And that thought is one of them. Just try to imagine that. And if you can't do it, if it's too booga-booga, metaphysical, philosophical, tough for you to get a hold of, let me help you to see that you do it one-third of your life when you're sleeping. A third of your life you spend sleeping, one-third, since you got here. And when you go to sleep, what do? You leave your form. And you live in a different set of rules altogether. You experience in a different set of rules. Let me tell you how the rules are different when you're asleep and in non-form than when you're in form. There's no beginning and there's no end. There's no cause and there's no effect. There's no time. There's no life. There's no death. Is there anybody in the room who has ever had the experience of being with somebody who's been dead while you're asleep? Your grandmother, your great-grandmother, whatever. She's there. She's there for you. How many of you have ever had the experience of being younger than you are? Like you're 18, you're back, you're 18 again. And you're there. And you look like you're 18, don't you? I mean, I have this horrible dream. I'm in the Navy. Back in the Navy. 4 years. It's September the 4th. It's 1962. And they forgot my discharge date. They just forgot. And I can't get anybody to acknowledge that I've now done my 4 years, and it's time for me to be out now. I got to go home. I got to go to college. I've got to get married. I've got to get on with my life. And everybody's going, well, I don't see any. I can't find your records. Sometimes I'm giving a speech, and I don't have any clothes on. Happens to me a lot. I suggest to you that when you are in this dimension called dreaming, that the rules are very different. And the reason that you dream is to teach you that every obstacle you run into is an opportunity. That's one of the things you learn. And get this, everything that you need in your dream, you create. Whatever you need for the dream. Whatever you need. You're driving along freeway. You're just driving along, right? And all of a sudden, the road ends, and there's a cliff. Yeah, a cliff! So what do you do with that?
You just sprout some wings somehow. You just sort of, sure, I think I'll just fly tonight. And you fly, don't you? You just fly right over. You don't die. You never die in your dream. You create out of that obstacle whatever you need for the dream, don't you? If you are underwater and you have to stay there for an hour, that is no problem. It isn't. You just get some gills, you stay under there, and you just hide, and you wait, don't you? One third of your life is spent in this state called thought, pure thought. And you are experiencing all of it. It's all there for you. You can have it all. You can do anything that you want. You create everything that you need. And yet the rules are very different. Very, very different indeed. And you don't wake up and go, oh, my God, whew, you just see that you're now in a different dimension. You don't say, oh, my, I didn't have a body. Oh, my God, that was an illusion. Because somebody's coming at you with a knife in a dream, and you wake up, and your heart is really pumping. And so the reaction to it is real. But you look back and you say, that's an illusion. There was nobody. There was no knife. Where's the knife?
This whole business about dreaming is really, really interesting to me, because it's the only way that we can get a handle on another level of consciousness. Because we do enter a new realm. We do go to sleep at night. Everybody has the experience of this. And we all dream. And when we dream, we live in another world. And that world is a world of pure thought. Even though the experience of what we're dreaming manifests itself in our bodies. One of the most interesting phenomena that a human being goes through, to me, is what is called politely a nocturnal emission, which is really a wet dream. That phenomenon is really interesting to me, because most of the time you think, well, in order to have a sexual experience, you need to have some kind of contact with form. I mean, this is a form thing. But like when you're asleep and you have this experience, man has this experience, it's like that's done purely through thought. Thought now creates in form the opportunity for life. And life can literally be created through thought, which is what is happening when two people who love each other or who don't love each other, two people are having a sexual encounter. That still is thought. I mean, the largest sex organ that we have is our brain, okay? It's all done through thought. And if you can't think it and you can't get the image, then you can't make it happen. So that the dance of life is possible just through thought and nothing more. And that makes me think that the stuff of life is thought. Now, there's different levels of consciousness that we have. I like to think of it as a stepladder. It's one of those stepladders that has only three steps on it. The bottom level, the bottom rung of the ladder, is dreaming consciousness. And then the next rung of the ladder up is your waking consciousness. And then the next rung of the ladder is a question mark. That's just another level of consciousness beyond the waking consciousness. So we got dream consciousness, one step up, waking consciousness, which is what we go through all the time, and you and I are doing right now. And then we got this other level of consciousness that goes beyond this waking consciousness. We'll just call it a question mark for now. Now, in the bottom level, in the lowest rung of the ladder, you're dreaming. I had like really bizarre experiences of dreaming, because I could be dreaming and somebody could come and talk to me while I was dreaming. My brothers used to do this to me. And they'd get my mother over there and they'd get family over there and they'd say, look at this guy. My oldest brother would be talking to me. And one time he gave me a sheet. And he said, here, this is your shirt. Now you're going to school, Wayne. Now come on, get your shirt on. And I had this sheet, and I'm trying to get my arm into this sheet, but there's no armhole in the sheet, all right? And I got this crazy thing going. And he's saying to my mother, look at this guy. I mean, he just thinks he's getting dressed. There was another time when I was dreaming about shoveling snow. I said out loud, where's my shovel? Where's my shovel? Okay, I'm gonna do this out loud. But I was in the dream, all right? I'm in a different level of consciousness. So the dream is real for me. I remember, the only time you know you're dreaming is when you're awakened. So you have to awaken to know that what you were just doing was an illusion. So my brother would say to me, here's your shovel, Wayne. Here, take the shovel. And I would then take the shovel. He was on the second rung. He was in waking consciousness, talking to me in dream consciousness. And he would join me and cooperate with me in that. Now, as long as he would do that, as long as he would cooperate with me and pretend to be with me in the dream, then I would cooperate and stay with that. But if he were to say to me, now, Wayne, you're crazy, you're dreaming, this isn't, just wake up, or this is stupid, or what, I would either go deeper into my unconsciousness, or I would come out of it and wake up, and then I would realize there was no shovel. And that's what happened eventually. I just woke up, and I said, where's my shovel? And then Jim said, you're awake, and I said, oh, there's no shovel, okay? But I had the experience of having the shovel. Now, that's the difference between the dream consciousness level and the waking consciousness level. What I suggest, just as something to think about, is that in order to go from one level of consciousness to another level, you have to have somebody who's at that level of consciousness go down there with you and pretend to be with you. And I suggest that now we go to the third rung, which has the question mark. And what is that level of consciousness, and how is it different? That if somebody from that level of consciousness were wanting to convince us or have us know what it's possible for us at a higher level than we're living right now, then they would have to pretend to be among us, wouldn't they, in order for us to, just like from the waking consciousness to the dream consciousness. And that person would come disguised and would pretend to be with us in the dream. That's what I think highly spiritual people are. They see the illusion. They know that the experience of the illusion is real, but they still see that it can't be. You can't own anything, you can't have it, you can't get a hold of it. It's possible they could come disguised as a carpenter, you know, which a lot of people say Jesus Christ was, someone from another level of consciousness who was coming here, pretending to walk among us, and showing us that we don't have to live this illusion, but it's still there with us, but then leaves, and leaves to another dimension. And that Buddha and many highly spiritual people right here on this planet right now who understand this higher level of consciousness, but sort of stay with us and almost pretend and help us along through it, but are trying to get people to see, don't you see that there's a higher place you can get to? And that higher place isn't form, it's transformation. And when you get that, then you can go in and out of this next dimension, and then the next dimension, and the next dimension. And there are many, many, many dimensions. I mean, human beings are multidimensional people. And the shovel that was handed to me, which wasn't really real, when I look back on it, I said, oh, that's just an illusion. But my experience of it was very real. I suggest that when we die, when we leave our form, that we will also be able to look back and see the illusion of all of the stuff that we accumulate and we hold onto, all of our shovels, all of the money, all of the accumulations and all of that, that we can't take with, and to see that we created everything that we needed in the level that we're at now. We created all, everything we need. If you need a partner that you need to fight with every day, then you bring that, you create that. If you need to have poverty for some reason in your life, just like in your dream. In the dream consciousness, everything you need for the dream, you create. Everything that you need. And the only way you verify that it's real is by having other people say, you know, I mean, how do you verify that anything is real? Well, you get 100 people together and you say, is that real or isn't that real? And eventually they all say, yes, that's real. But in the dream, you can get 100 people. You can call them all in and you can create everybody that you need. It's just speculation. It's metaphysical speculation. But for me, it becomes the essence of life. I know that there are higher dimensions than this waking consciousness level that we live in. I know that. And I know that I can come back here and live the illusion all the time and enjoy it all, enjoy the experience of it all, make it all work for me. And everything that I've got that is going on for me in my life, I create. I create whatever I need. If I need to have a house full of children, then I create that. If I need to have an experience of losing my keys, or whatever, I take responsibility for it all. For everything that happens in my life, I create it all. In order to make the dream work, in order to make this level of consciousness work. But you will get yourself to a higher level when you'll look back on all of that and you'll say, well, what did I need that for? Now, my grandmother just died a few years ago. I just know that there's nothing that could have ever killed her. I just know that the essence of my grandmother couldn't have died, and that everything that she accumulated and needed and had to do in her 95 years while she was here, that she can now see from a different level of consciousness, was all an illusion. It was all just stuff that she was going through, that she was creating. And now you're in a different dimension, and in another dimension. And it's all multidimensional. And how can anybody dispute that? How can it be disputed to me? It just seems so real. This whole concept of dying, when I talked about getting older, it's like once you understand that you are not your body, that it only represents a tiny portion of who you are, then fearing death isn't impossible anymore. And it's part of the enlightenment process, or the no-limit process. that you can't kill thoughts. Thoughts are energy. You can't kill feelings. Feelings are the result of thoughts. And that matter or form or our bodies are just things that change form all the time. But that our essence, that who we are as a human being, is the entire mental process, the entire thinking process, the entire attitude process, and that our evolving as human beings is really in the way that we think and process our world, rather than how our bodies take shape and lose their shape eventually. And that death becomes something you look at as absolutely necessary and nothing to fear. And we fear what we don't face, and what we don't face controls us. And if you face it and understand that a mental image, which is really what our experience of life is, I mean, think about it. Everything that you experience in life is a mental image. You can never be the process that constitutes somebody else. I can never get behind your eyeballs and look out and see the world the way you see it. I can never be your liver and be your kidney and be what you are. No matter how much I love you and care about you, I have to get a level away from you because I can't be the process that you are. And when you get inside of yourself and look at yourself and face who you are, you begin to see that you are not that liver, you are not that kidney. You are your unique perceptual approach to everything in life. You are your attitudes, if you will. You are your thoughts. And those never die. And here's how I handle it. I tell people, a third of your life, one third of your life you spend outside of your form. One third of your life. This third of your life is when you're sleeping and when you're dreaming. And this is real. This isn't like you're put on hold for this 8 hours that you leave your form. You just leave your body. And all dreaming is just mental experiences. How many listening have ever had the experience of dreaming something, being awakened unexpectedly, and having the feeling of wanting to go back to sleep so that I can find out how the dream came out? I mean, everybody's had that experience, all right? When I ask audiences that over, and I say, well, what's going on here? If you're creating it, if you're writing the script, these are your inventions, these thoughts that you're experiencing, then why would you ever need to go back to sleep to find out how it came out, what the outcome was? When you're writing it, it would be like me sitting down writing a story, wondering how it's going to come out. I mean, if I'm writing it, then I would create what I want to. So that in that period of your life, that one third of your life, when there's no time, when there's no space, when there are no limits of any kind, and it's very real, and your body is affected very dramatically by those thoughts. I mean, you can wake up in perspiration. You can wake up all excited. And if those thoughts are something that you are creating, then you must know that you wouldn't ever have that experience of wanting to go back there. So that's, to me, that's the analogy that I use for crossing over or dying, whatever it is, that the thoughts don't end. You can be with someone who's been dead for 20 years. You can fly. And you really can fly while you're dreaming, can't you? Thoughts. Always thoughts. And you've transcended your form at that time, all right? If we are those thoughts, and those thoughts are unlimited in one third of our life, maybe, just maybe, those thoughts are what happens when we leave here, when we go on, when what we call death, which is just the death of our form, takes over. We can have whatever we want. It's the ultimate transcending of your form. I really, absolutely, completely am convinced of that. That thought is something that can't be destroyed, and we are thought. Therefore, we can never be destroyed. I don't pretend to have a handle on the great mysteries of the universe, but I have no fear of death whatsoever because I know that you can't kill thought. Thought is a vibration. It's the ultimate vibration in the universe. When you understand that and get that, it's no longer anything to be feared. The universe goes forever. It's an endless thing. A heart starts beating inside of a mother's womb at 6-7 weeks after conception, and it's a total mystery that you'll ever need for your entire life in the form that you're in. It's all a mystery. And while we are dreaming, while we are sleeping, it is unlimited. There are no limits. to what you can do while you're sleeping. None whatsoever. You can be anything. You can go anywhere. You can be any age. You can do anything. And it's totally freeing, and it's very real, and you experience it very dramatically. And you're not ever afraid to go to sleep because, oh, my God, I'm leaving my body, and this is awful, and I can't. You're never afraid to do that, you know? So why be afraid to change this form? Why be afraid of it? It's just part of the isness of it all. When we're born, we show up and we come here from nowhere. We're in a place called nowhere. We have an eternal spirit, this higher part of ourselves. It's not in the world of form. It has no boundaries to it at all. And I call this being in nowhere. Now spell it out for yourself. N-O-W-H-E-R-E, nowhere. And suddenly we appear. And now we go from nowhere to now here. N-O-W-H-E-R-E. It's exactly the same. Nowhere to now here, which is your life, and then you go back to nowhere. But who you really are, what your awareness is, this higher part of yourself, was there in nowhere, it's here and now here, and it'll be with you when you go back to nowhere. That which was never born never dies. So the part of you that was never born, that is eternal, that is changeless, is really what your greatest challenge is about, and it really is what heightened awareness is about. And once you discover this part of yourself by looking and facing in a different direction than you've ever faced before in your life, instead of facing out, now you're facing in. And as you do this experiment, you begin to discover that what happened is that when you showed up here, and now here, you had a whole host of very well-meaning sponsors, folks that have all shown up in your life, folks called your parents, folks called your neighbors, folks called your teachers, some of them called spiritual counselors or your priests and ministers and rabbis and people like that who've been in your life, many of your friends, all of these people are very well-meaning, and they've all sort of given you a recipe, if you will, for what your life is about, what your limitations are, what's possible for you, what's not possible for you. And this is called your experience of awareness. And you have literally signed a contract or an agreement with what it is that's going to constitute your awareness for your time here in now here. So here we are in now here. We've gone from nowhere. Somehow, in some mysterious way, I don't claim to know how that happened. I don't have a clue. I'm just part of the same process that you are. I showed up here the same way you did. But I know I went from nowhere to now here. I know that my life is what Joel Goldsmith called a parenthesis in eternity. You know, it opens parentheses at the moment of our conception, and it closes parentheses at the instant of our death. And we go from nowhere to now here, surrounded by eternity. And the part of us that is eternal is the higher part of ourselves. The part of us that is not eternal, the physical part of us, is something that is constantly changing. Part of ourselves, this divine part of ourselves, if you will, is now here. And we write an agreement with what it is that's going to constitute our reality. And that agreement says that there are only certain things that we can do and certain things that we can't do. And that we can only accomplish so much, and we can only run so fast, and we can only do so many things.